headlines. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says enemies have been seeking to advance their malicious political agenda by waging an economic war against the Iranian nation. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams the Israeli president's trip to the UAE, saying the visit emboldens the regime to commit more crimes against Palestinians. And Canadians rally in Ottawa against mandatory COVID vaccination. Reports say Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his family have been moved to a secure location. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Iran's leader says enemies have been seeking to advance their political plots against the country through an economic war. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said an economic collapse was a prelude to wicked political goals. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, enemies sought to pit the Iranian nation against the Islamic establishment. The leader cited an example of economic enterprises that have not tied their operations to the removal of sanctions, adding that Iran's economy should not be contingent on issues over which officials have no control. The leader made the remarks during an address to a group of Iranian manufacturers. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Mostafa Khoshcheshm, journalist and political commentator, who is joining us live from Tehran. Thank you very much, Mr. Khoshcheshm. Now, it was quite interesting, the leader's remarks, and of course pointing out that no one should actually tie their hopes to something that is uncertain, which is the negotiations.
Hello, Yusuf, thanks for having me. Well, true. This economic warfare or the sanctions policy is part of the United States carrot and stick, which came into practice within the containment strategy over a decade ago. And alongside, Richard Nephew was known to be the architect of the sanctions at the U.S. administration. Kenneth Katzman led the sanctions group at the Congress, and I remember quite well that over a decade ago, when post-election riots in 2009 happened, and after several months, rioters disappeared almost from the streets. Kenneth Katzman ran an interview with, Times Magazine or New York Times, where he said that we are imposing the sanctions in order to wear off the public support of the Islamic Republic so that these people who take out to the streets on February 11 rallies or marking the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution victory or the Quds Day rallies, they are from the lower classes of the society, so these sanctions could dissuade them from supporting the Islamic Republic and turn them against the establishment, hopefully. And we do that, he said at that time, in order to reinvigorate the rioters, the numbers in the streets. And then they started this kind of warfare against the Islamic Republic, but not to topple the Islamic Republic, because they knew it. And this, sanctions policy came into practice for the containment strategy. So the next step was, forcing Iran into talks that we all experienced under the JCPOA. This was not hidden to the Iranian supreme leader and establishment. I remember quite well when President Rouhani was very much hopeful about the talks, and he intended to start the talks. He was advised by the Iranian leader repeatedly that, okay, you could go ahead to do the talks, but you need to have a parallel plan B that's working on Iranian economy in order to decrease the efficiency of the sanctions, because it's a weapon of the United States and you need to decrease it, its efficiency, in order to dissuade the U.S. from using this kind of weapon against the Iranians. So that's government failed to, keep the parallel, the balance between these two. But now that it's been proved to the Iranians that they need to rely on their domestic economy, and they voted for President Raisi to do the same, now Iran has the instruments. And I believe that in the first few months of this administration, Iran has done quite well in order to make sure that the peak of the sanctions efficiency is gone. That's why probably the Iranian leader spoke about this now and not a few months ago, because now we rest assured that we could do a lot. Let's remember that despite the allegations made by the U.S. and Israeli experts and officials, this is not the Biden administration that has gone soft on Iran or the sanctions on Iran and purchase of oil by foreign, you know, countries and firms. On the contrary, they've done their best, sent three of their top diplomats, like Nicholas Burns, now the ambassador to China, as well as Wendy Sherman and William Burns, to China to dissuade China from buying crude from Iran a few months before the start of the negotiations with Iran. And they did their best in order to freeze, to keep Iranian frozen assets abroad, but they failed. Now Iran is developing a lot of foreign trade with Russia, China. Iran's crude sales have been on increase despite the U.S. opposition. Iran is doing business with Latin America growingly. And even the UAE, that's working hard with the U.S. and it's an agent or proxy of the U.S. in this region, they sent delegations to Iran in order to expand economic cooperation with Iran, despite the fact that the U.S. requested them and warned them to stop doing so unless the JCPOA is back into life. But
well, it seems that we've lost Mr. Khoshish. We'll be talking to him shortly again. Moving on. Tehran and Moscow are moving toward a financial alliance, with an Iranian lawmaker saying that the two sides will be ditching the U.S. dollar from their trade transactions. Ebrahim Rezaei, who chairs the Iran-Russia Parliamentary Friendship Group, says the two sides have agreed to move towards de-dollarization and breaking the monopoly of the U.S. currency and trade deals. The two sides have also reached agreements in energy, monetary, banking, and transportation areas during discussions that took place when Iranian president visited Moscow earlier this month. According to the legislator, the two countries have agreed to use marine transportation to facilitate trade. They're also planning to exchange their agricultural produce. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams the ongoing official trip by Israeli president to the United Arab Emirates. Hamas says the visit takes place amid continued Israeli crimes against Palestinians. It says that such visits embolden the regime to commit more crimes and violate Palestinians' rights. The movement also says normalization with Israel only serves the Zionist interests in the region. The Israeli president arrived in Abu Dhabi on Sunday morning for a two-day visit. He is the first Israeli president to visit the UAE. The Sheikh, along with Bahrain, established diplomatic relations with Israel 2 years ago under U.S. brokered deals. Palestinians see the normalization as a betrayal of their cause. Israeli media say their president will use the UAE visit to encourage more Persian Gulf Arab nations to normalize with Tel Aviv. Now, Israeli president is in the United Arab Emirates for talks, so with leaders of that country. Greeting the president in Abu Dhabi, UAE foreign minister has hailed this visit actually as one of the huge steps towards a successful relationship. Now, this is the first time an Israeli president is visiting the Sheikh Tam. He will be meeting with top Emirati officials, including the crown prince and the UAE, as we said to you before, along with Bahrain, established diplomatic relations with Israel 2 years ago in U.S. brokered deals. Palestinians see this as a betrayal of their cause. New reports coming out of the United States has transferred hundreds of Daesh terrorists from a prison in northeast Syria to a location in the east. That reportedly happened after the terror group attacked the prison last week. We discussed those developments in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
New reports emerging of the U.S. role in northeastern Syria. American forces have transferred 750 Daesh terrorists, most of them foreigners, from a prison in Hasaka province. Russian media are quoting special sources as saying that the detainees have been transferred to a desert in Deir al-Zor province. They say U.S. coalition drones perform monitoring operations to secure their exit routes until they arrived at their destination near the town of Bukemah. Sources say the transfer process took place in batches by SUVs and buses. A number of top Daesh leaders holding Arab, Belgian, and Dutch nationalities were among the escapees. Last week, Daesh attacked the detention center. Heavy fighting then ensued. Kurdish-led forces, who are allies of the U.S., are fighting the Syrian government, and they are running the prison. Syria's UN envoy has blamed Washington for the clashes. Bassam Sabak says that the U.S. is seeking to recycle Daesh and justify American military presence in Syria. Now, to get some insight into that story, let me invite a couple of guests. We'll have our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joining us. Also, Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, is joining us out of Sydney. Let's first go to Damascus. Mohammed, give us some more information and what we hear in news reports regarding this transfer of Daesh forces by U.S.
Yes, Russian media reported that the United States transported 750 Daesh terrorists from Hasakeh to the countryside of Deir ez-Zor, mainly around Abu Kamal on the borderline between Syria and Iraq, and to area near Al-Bishri mountain, also in Deir ez-Zor's southern countryside. Now, according to reports, even the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, which works with the United States over there, forces on the ground in Al-Hasakeh, retreated from three positions around the Ghoiran prison, which Daesh attacked a week ago, and allowed terrorists to escape from those three positions towards two areas in Al-Hasakeh where they gathered. Then the SDF helped them to get out and reach those areas in Deir ez-Zor countryside. According to those reports by Russian media, also the U.S.-led coalition reconnaissance drones helped those Daesh terrorists and directed them to use special routes over there in that desert of Deir ez-Zor to reach those areas. Now, this is definitely not the first time that cooperation between Daesh and the United States in that area of Syria is reported. Russia said it many times that even the United States is training directly those terrorists of Daesh in its illegal base of Al-Tanf on the borderline between Syria and Iraq. And also the Syrian government, always officials note to that support of the United States to Daesh. And it says always that the United States wants to help Daesh to keep control in some areas in order to use that as a pretext to stay occupying Syria.
Now we have a clear picture. Now, let me ask Tim Anderson about what the U.S. is exactly is doing in Syria. We had that prison attack where, you know, Daesh inmates, some of them were able to flee. And then now we have the U.S. moving these terrorists. Maybe they call them good terrorists. I don't know. Every now and then, you know, definitions change. Good terrorists, bad terrorists, modern ones. So what's the U.S. exactly doing in Syria?
Well, Daesh has always been a creature of the U.S. to try and destabilize Syria and Iraq. It was created first in Iraq back in 2004, 2005, then exported to Syria in 2012. And there have been constant reports of U.S. direct collaboration with Daesh in Syria and Iraq from Syrian, Iraqi, and Iranian sources since 2014. Now, more recently, there were Syrian television reports of Daesh terrorists who were captured by the Syrians and confessed they'd come from the U.S. base in Al-Tanf to attack the Syrian army in Palmyra and the T4 air base. 3 months ago, there was a report of a number of Daesh families moved across to Iraq. So there are these constant reports, and the latest one, of course, is significant in that a large number of fighters have been moved down to the one border post in the border between Iraq and Syria, which is controlled by Iraq and Syria. So the U.S. has been launching missile attacks on that base for a long time, and also the bombing in Al-Baghouz was two years ago was linked to that too. So the latest thing is another step in a series of constant collaborations which the U.S. has tried to keep hidden, but clear direct collaborations with Daesh to try and keep destabilizing Syria and Iraq and to keep the two countries apart.
Okay, Tim, how can the U.S. say that? Because as you said, they were the ones who created groups like Daesh, and that's what Donald Trump alluded to, you know, Hillary Clinton and others during the Obama era. And then they launch the so-called war on terror. They fight what they call terrorists in some parts of the world, and then they go in and broad daylight support them, and they're doing what they're doing now in Syria.
It's a larger scale of what's called a protection racket in U.S. terms. Basically, they demand that they be paid for protection, basically. And, of course, they're claiming their presence in Iraq and Syria to this day is to fight Daesh, when from the Syrian and Iraqi and Iranian sources, we know the relationship has been one of constant collaboration. So the problem is, of course, that in the propaganda war stakes, the U.S. media will never admit this. They never acknowledge this at all. Even when the massacre in Al-Baghouz was revealed by the New York Times some months ago, they claimed it was in the middle of the fog of war fighting ISIS in that same part of Syria that these 750 terrorists have now been sent to around the Al-Bukamal border crossing.
Okay, I appreciate your contribution. Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Sydney.
Social anger over mandatory COVID vaccination has now reached Canada, with thousands of people turning out in Ottawa to protest the mandates announced by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. The march began as truckers protested against the obligatory vaccination for entry into the U.S., but the city's residents later joined the convoy and marched on the parliament. The protest was held amid tight security triggered by violent rhetoric that promoters used on social media. There are reports that Trudeau and his family were moved to a secure location from their downtown Ottawa home. 77% of Canada's population has received two jabs. That includes 90% of truckers. Canada made vaccination mandatory for federal workers in October. A similar mandate was jointly announced with the U.S. for cross-border truckers last month. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Richard Ogg, a Silverhead former electrician who switched to making his living catching crabs 2 decades ago, is a staunch supporter of the union representing fishing boat captains along America's western seaboard. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Chris McGreal. The piece is titled, American Fishers Want to Sue Big Oil for Killing Their Trade. But there's a catch. Richard Ogg, a silver-haired former electrician who switched to making his living catching crabs 2 decades ago, is a staunch supporter of the union representing fishing boat captains along America's western seaboard. But when he heard the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the PCFFA, was suing some of the world's largest oil companies for causing the climate crisis, Richard Ogg took stock of the barrels of diesel oil stacked on his vessel, the 54-foot Karen Jean, and wondered if the litigation was not only a mistake, but hypocritical. How do we run our engines without oil? How do we fish without oil? Electricity? I'm a small vessel, I'm only 68 tons, and my God, I don't know how that would work, said Ogg, who fishes out of Bodega Bay, about 70 miles north of San Francisco, California. The environmental harm brought by rising ocean temperatures has severely undercut fishing seasons and supplies, at a steep cost to the industry. And so, in response to years of setbacks, union leaders pursued a novel strategy to reclaim lost earnings, by going after one of the culprits responsible for driving global temperatures. 3 years ago, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the PCFFA, became the first private organization to join the growing number of lawsuits accusing the oil and gas industry of covering up research that warned about the dangers of burning fossil fuels. The plaintiffs want compensation for damage caused by global heating and to meet the cost of new infrastructure to cope with the climate crisis. They also demand the oil industry change its ways. Richard Ogg is not alone among West Coast fishing boat owners in questioning the association's lawsuit. And the head of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, Mike Conroy, knows it. When I first heard of this lawsuit, I had the very same thought. This is ridiculous, Conroy said. Mike Conroy said, he understands the lawsuit looks hypocritical to many people because the fishing industry is so dependent on oil. But he said his views shifted when he looked more closely at the actions of the fossil fuel industry, particularly its cover-up of the warnings from its own scientists and its continued efforts to undermine measures to contain global heating. The skepticism among Conroy's members about suing Big Oil reflects sharp divisions in American society about responsibility for the deepening environmental emergency and the challenges litigants face in attempting to hold the industry to account. It's controversial, I get it, Mike Conroy adds. But then I learned that these oil companies were doubling down on these things they knew were bad. And if we're putting forth effort to reduce our impacts on the climate, then we shouldn't be doing that alone. The Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, representing about 900 family-owned fishing boats on the Pacific coast, sued after a surge in blooms of toxic algae shut down fishing for Dungeness crab. The crabs are Oregon's most valuable catch, pumping about $75 million a year into the state's economy, and account for about one quarter of California's revenues from fishing. In 2013, a huge pool of warm water that became known as the Blob appeared off the Pacific coast. 2 years later, the Blob had grown to more than 2,000 miles long, running from the Mexican border to Alaska. Water temperatures rose to 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit, 2.5 degrees Celsius above normal, causing an increase in the neurotoxin domoic acid that delayed the opening of the 2015 Dungeness crab season along the west coast of the United States by months. The shutdown cost more than $100 million in lost earnings and wages by some estimates. Two-thirds of boats were docked and others had to move to different fisheries. The total catch was only about half of a normal year. I know a number of folks that lost their boats, they lost their homes, they lost their families, said Mike Conroy. Commercial crabbers face shortened seasons again in the following years because toxicity levels remained high and marine heat waves shifted krill closer to the shore, drawing endangered humpback and blue whales into crabbing areas where they are in danger of becoming entangled in fishing lines. In its lawsuit, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations blamed the blob on global heating caused by the burning of fossil fuels and is seeking compensation for a harmful algal bloom unprecedented in its extent and in its persistence. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration study last year concluded that climate change is likely to result in a sharp rise in marine heat waves and a perpetuation of toxic blooms that might otherwise have washed away, with domoic acid hotspots becoming more frequent and more intense. The Dungeness crab season was again delayed last year on parts of the West Coast after new domoic acid hotspots were identified off the coast of Oregon, including near the port of Newport. Clint Funderburg, a member of the Oregon Coast Crab Association who fishes out of Newport, said he was reluctant to pin responsibility for the domoic acid outbreak solely on the climate crisis and therefore the fossil fuel industry. They were some hard years, but these problems come and go. I'm not saying there isn't climate change, but there's a history of domoic acid on this coast, and I don't know if we can say it's one thing or the other causing it, he said. Richard Ogg does domoic acid testing for the state along a 30-mile stretch of coast in his area. He said the readings are consistently up, but like other fishing, his Pacific coast, he notices that it coincides with an intensification of the vineyard industry. Climate change definitely is real. We know that, and it is impacting us. But it's really, at times, a cyclical thing. What we're looking at is a combination of a lot of things that are breaking down the system. It's not one thing in particular, he said. Toxic algae blooms have made regular appearances along America's west coast. An outbreak is believed responsible for the Great Bird Frenzy around beachside communities in Santa Cruz, California in 1961, which played a part in shaping Alfred Hitchcock's classic film, The Birds. But the intensity of the recent outbreaks and the scale of the blob has scientists worried. Studies also show that the ocean is absorbing more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, making it more acidic. Among other things, higher acid levels affects the ability of crustaceans to build their shells. In the early 2000s, the increased acidity killed off large numbers of young oysters and mussels unable to form shells. Last year, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, released a study that showed that baby Dungeness crabs were being exposed to the same corrosive waters. Still, there remains the question of culpability. We all use diesel on our boats, said Clint Funderburg. I'm not going to point the finger just at the oil companies. They sell it, we buy it. The oil and gas industry has spent years deflecting from its central part in global heating, pushing the claim that it is doing no more than selling a legal product and that it is the individual user who bears responsibility for putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Four of the companies sued by the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, that is Chevron, Exxon, BP, and Shell, are responsible for more than 10% of the world's carbon emissions since 1965. 19 of the 20 largest carbon emitters over the same period were oil and gas producers. But the major polluters have had some success in following the tactic of the tobacco industry and gun makers in seeking to disperse responsibility by putting the onus on individual user rather than the manufacturers. A Guardian opinion poll published in October showed that strategy has paid off, with 31% of the American public saying that individuals are completely or mostly responsible for the climate crisis. For his part, Richard Ogg is fatalistic. "The problem for me is suing. It never seems to solve the problem. The oil companies aren't going to be hurt by a lawsuit. In fact, they want to continue, and they're going to continue," he said. Mike Conroy sees it differently. He says the lawsuit is intended to punish bad behavior and pressure the oil industry into changing its ways. "A lot of my members don't have the time to sit back and actually give this a lot of thought, which is unfortunate. But after the last crab season in California, I think more and more of the fishermen are starting to ask questions that need to be asked," he said.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
Yeah, all clear there, unless me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward and the workers got to battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt, and it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath, though.
Yeah, probably too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any bruise where you've got it all over you, you're wet through some bloody days.
What, just cover them and stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean
one. Oh, right, okay.
About there? Yeah.
And you can Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole, and they crunched them up with the dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on, digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
Drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 245T, which was thought to be more toxic than 24D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
What many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for the sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is the sample.
Great.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gall sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 24D. Tests on one 2,4-D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 2,4-D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case, that industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 2,4-D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 2,4-D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
2,4-D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 2,4-D?
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine, just outside of Melbourne, and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked. It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost 7 times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community, because authorities are not routinely testing. Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised, because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides. And that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory, make sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and them not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. Last year at Loxton, he lost his entire harvest because 2,4-D sprayed on another property drifted onto his grapes. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
It's a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas, and it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products. What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further, so they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as
Absolutely.
Well.
Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he's constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
Cos leather's growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There's no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking up from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals, and the environment. It's yet to finish that review. Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995, but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
Some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believe this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Remember that you can contact us through our email, or better yet, through Facebook and Twitter. Until next week and another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.